once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English, Dad.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and...
Jake.
McClure.
We did it. Now we're done.
Yeah, but I
said our names. That. We are complete for the day.
That's good. Let's see, what else do we need to say? We need to say that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of an SEC registered, well, we should say that, we need to say that some way that would please the SEC. A registered investment advisory firm that is, regulated by the SEC.
Okay.
Well, that doesn't imply.
You can't really please the SEC.
Well, you can less displease them.
Yeah,
okay, so
yeah,
that is that is regulated but neither approved nor disapproved, and the secretary will deny all knowledge.
Yes. So when I say that, it's not to denigrate the SEC. They're intended not to be pleasable. Kind of like if you're getting investigated by somebody, you don't want them pleased with you while they're investigating you.
And I also need to say that we advertise... No, but back up. We don't pay for the radio show. The radio show doesn't pay us. No, the station. We don't pay the station. The station doesn't pay us, but we do advertise for the radio show on the station.
Yes. Right.
Okay.
And we have a...
Information that we present on this radio program is obtained, has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable. Deem is a good word there.
Yes.
But we make no warranty or guarantee as to the completeness or accuracy of that information. And there's another one I got to do too, and I can't remember what it is off the top of my head. There's another one. Oh,
this is educational, not investment
advice, and you should not act on it. Please consult with your local registered investment advisor.
And I was going to tell him something about memory cues, but I don't remember what it was.
Yeah, well, we got a telephone call on 773-1400, which is our local telephone number, 254-773-1400. It's also our long-distance telephone number. And caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just going to ask y'all a question before you get at your business at hand. Supposing somebody buys a building, and they want to remodel this building, and they knock a few walls down, you know, change things around, and out of surprise, they found like $150,000 in their old money, you know, probably from the 60s and 70s. Is that your money because it's in your property, it's in your building, or do you have to report it? You have a good day, sir.
All right.
That's a good question.
It is a good question. It may or may not be your property. That's the easiest answer. You do need to report it. It should remain your property until they can prove that it's related to a crime. If they can prove that it's related to a crime, it needs to be returned, if it's old money, to the heirs of the people it was stolen from. This is true. There was a case up in the Northeast a couple of years ago where a lady was out walking her dog on a piece of property they just purchased, and they found an old coffee can that was full of gold coins. And so they checked into it and went hunting around. The gold coins belong to her until it's proven that they were stolen from someone.
But that doesn't keep the police from impounding them.
Right. And they may impound them if it's reporting that way. So you need to call your – if this were a real scenario rather than hypothetical, you would need to call an attorney right away.
Yes. Call an attorney and ask
that
question. And
have the attorney report it properly to the correct authorities so that if it's impounded, it's only at following your rights and privileges rather than the whims of the police department. The police department's allowed to impound it if it's reported in certain ways. So if it's reported as lost money, they're going to impound it. If it's reported properly, and this is where we have to clearly define we're not attorneys, if it's reported properly, it's highly likely that you'll get to keep it, depending on where it came from. There's a bunch of situations going back. If I remember from my childhood, in downtown Killeen, there was a building renovation going on. The man was taking an old house and converting it to an optical store. Do you remember this?
I do.
And in the process, this old house, which just kind of breaks my heart a little bit. This is an old house. This is Civil War era old. They broke into a wall and found a hidden room that had a bunch of Confederate memorabilia from the person who actually used it, an officer's saber and a uniform, a bunch of stuff that obviously it, after the war, was not stuff that you want to just lying about. So they covered it up, and evidently everybody forgot about it and opened it up, and that stuff's worth significant amount of money for its historical context now. He got to keep that. So he knocked it open, found it. It's not like the police are going to say, that's mine, give it to me. I'm going to impound this. It might have been from someone else. But they could if it's reported as a lost item.
And it's legal property. It's part of the property. It's not currency. Currency is... You may think this is a little strange.
Currency doesn't belong to us.
That's the point. If you have a dollar bill in your hand, it does not belong to you. If you have a coin in your hand, it does not belong to you. You have possession.
Yeah, it says a note on the bill. That means it's a loan to you from the Federal Reserve. It's a loan that's worth exactly one loan like it. So you could replace it with another one.
But it is the property of a joint venture, in essence, between the Federal Reserve Bank and the United States Treasury.
This is why it's illegal to deface it, because it doesn't belong to you. But what do you mean? I earned it. Well, yeah, but technically you just earned the right to have the loan. It's a fascinating concept to really get down into, but that's the only way we can control at the governmental level the quality of the currency.
Now, if you find a bunch of gold coins, there's a fair chance that they're no longer considered to be money.
Yeah.
And if they're not considered to be money, then it's yours, if it's on your property.
Unless it was stolen from somebody. And then it doesn't matter that it was on your property and buried there. It's still stolen property. And that means it doesn't belong to you.
Right. But somebody has to prove it was stolen.
So. Yes, and anyway, that's the thing.
So, let's talk about the markets just a second. The stock market, measured by the S&P 500 stock index, dropped 0.33% for the week, which doesn't sound like a lot. It was up 0.86 last week, down 0.33 this week. Until you look at the fact that it's cruising along, it has a wonderful recent gain. In other words, the last month, the S&P 500 is up 2.9%. It's up 9.24 for the trailing 3 months. But it's important to keep that in perspective. From end of July, the record-breaking stock market closes, and we had some earlier in the week, was up about 2.3%. From 2 years ago, February, it's up about 7%, so 3-point-some percent per year. So the 2.6, yeah, so it's a little over 5%. So it's 2.6% a year from 2 years ago. So all these records that you see in the S&P 500 are reminiscent of, remind me very much of the end of 1999 when we had a week never seemed to go by when we didn't break a record for the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500. But they would just barely break the record and they drop back. And that's what we're seeing going on right now with some pretty weak economic news. Now, we probably would have ended the week with a gain and a nice record again.
Except that the news came back.
There was a leak from the administration or someplace. Nobody knows where from.
We know for a fact there were leaks around the United States side, but there was direct confirmation from the Chinese.
But the issue is that we've hit a snag in these phase one agreement, and the New York Times published the details of the snag. Basically, the Chinese want tariff drops, and they don't want to commit to the exact dollar amount of agricultural purchases they're going to make.
Right.
Whereas the administration, and by the way, on that day, as soon as the New York Times published it, the president came out and said, if they don't agree, we'll raise tariffs more.
Yeah. So the market's not.
So the market slipped back down.
Just a little bit down.
It's one of those things where the stock market is pretty clearly focused on tariffs. And it is.
And that's a fascinating thing here.
We're about a 23.9 or 24 price-earnings ratio in the market. Now, that basically you take the price of the S&P 500 divided by its annual earnings, and you get a price-earnings ratio. And that is in the upper end of its traditional range.
Yeah.
It's very right at the top.
Right, of the long-term average traditional range. So now, it's gotten a lot higher than that in the past, but that's usually we look at that and say it's overpriced. So we're at the upper end of what we would consider a fair market value.
So the market is cruising along at the upper end of its traditional fair market value in terms of pure numbers. But it's what's kind of fascinating is the stock market has been ignoring negative economic news.
Yeah. 3 years ago, if the manufacturing numbers that we're seeing today were coming out, we would have a significant drop in the market, which is another symbol that this is a really mature bull. A really mature bull market, they tend to ignore and maybe even go up a little bit on bad news, thinking, well, this may cause the Fed to drop interest rates. Just think about that for a second. Fed dropping interest rates means the economy's in trouble. When the market responds favorably to a drop in interest rates or a rumor that may cause a drop in interest rates, it means that the bulls are in their high growth mode, and the bears are kind of somnolent. They're sleeping a little bit.
Meanwhile,
hibernation. It's a good time of year for bears to go into hibernation.
Meanwhile, the treasury, 10-year treasury note, which is a pretty strong indicator for the people who trade in the bond market think the economy is going, dropped, relatively speaking, about 9%. It yields 1.769% at the end. Remember, it was up around 1.9.
Can we have some more decimal points in there?
I
want to go out to like the millionth decimal.
But we can't.
We're only out to like the thousandth.
Yeah, but that's,
I would really like to go more.
When you're dealing with numbers this small, 1 point something.
Right.
More decimals are better.
Yeah, we can start to measure it. Yeah.
And oil was flat. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir, guys. Enjoy the show. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal today about a boomer who's going to buy your $21 million homes.
Yeah.
With the lifestyle changes of subsequent generations, I'm just wondering, is this going to risk having real estate mutual funds in a long-term portfolio line? If I'm a...
Okay.
Thank you.
It's a very complicated, believe it or not, that was a very complicated question, and there's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah. What's going on here? Okay. Let's give some background and some demographics. We mentioned this in the newsletter a little bit, that housing prices for the lower end are dropping because sales are down, specifically in the western side of the country, but pretty much everywhere. We're seeing that, yes, the housing market has peaked. The prices haven't come down. So the housing market really peaked about 18 months ago. But prices have continued up. Well, wait a minute.
Average prices have continued up.
Wait a minute. How is it that I say it peaked, but the prices have continued up? Because sales have dropped. The average prices have continued up, but the number of sales have dropped and dropped relatively drastically. Go ahead.
Sales were up this last month 1.9%. The problem is when the National Association of Realtors says sales are up 1.9%, they were talking about the fact that very, very high dollar houses were being traded between people who already owned them.
And there's another kind of key piece here. When you're talking about October and November and December, those are odd. Most years, we have very, very little sales in those months because people don't want to buy a house when they're going to their grandma's for Christmas. It's just a normal – Google used to have this great index that they did just on search tracks, how many people are searching for certain things. And they had a real estate index that every year you could see this drop, massive drop in late October through December. So if October sales are up, it doesn't take a lot of buying to be more than the last October. If we look at the whole year, we're pretty well down, and most of last year was down on sales. So when prices are continuing up and the sales are down, it's a symptom of the peak. And now we're starting to see prices drop on the lower end of the spectrum. And the sales that we are seeing, as you just said, are the expensive homes being traded between already expensive home owners. So they're leaving one home and going to another home. So they put their house on the market and they go buy a new house. Well, the person that's selling that new house is probably putting that house on the market so that they can go and buy a new home in about the same price range. So we're seeing that activity still going on, but sales are down even there. Last month they were up, but overall they're relatively down.
It's across the board we're seeing something that is certainly nothing like the bubble of 2007, but still similar in some ways. You're seeing at the upper end of the housing market, the $500,000 to $750,000 house, those are moving, but new entrants are not coming in because the new first home purchase is typically not $500,000 to $750,000.
Right.
And so what we're seeing is new home purchasers, people, first-time purchasers, are basically being locked out of the market by high prices, strict lending requirements, and just a shortage of lower-end homes. And there's a really good reason for the shortage of lower-end homes. You can't find enough people to build them.
Yeah. And there's another thing. And you just said this, and I'm going to repeat it. There's nothing new under the sun here. Recent surveys just came out to Generation Z and the Millennial generation, and the caller mentioned lifestyle changes. There are lifestyle changes, but they're the same lifestyle changes that we see every generation, which is the younger you are, the less likely you are to afford a house. And people always say, well, maybe that means this generation isn't going to be into home ownership. They said that about the Xers. They said it about the boomers. So each generation in their young years is saying, I'd rather rent. The surveys that just came out to millennials and Generation Z, because we haven't named them yet, although the Xers never got one, never got a name. We're just stuck with a letter. It's a pretty cool letter.
I'm cool.
An Xer, just as a side note. The surveys just came out and said millennials would vastly prefer to own their home rather than rent their home. Mm-hmm. And Generation Z would vastly prefer to own their home rather than rent their home, because this isn't about lifestyle. There's some aspect of lifestyle in it, but at some point you realize renting money is gone. While ownership money is going into equity, at least some piece of it, even if you're upside down for a while, you have this concept of eventually this thing will be mine.
There's a couple of other factors that are in here. One, we're moving less often. Very substantial drop in the number of household moves from one place to another among homeowners.
Which is normal when we're in a really booming economy.
We're owning our homes much longer between sales than we have in the past. But the caller asked about something that's pretty important, and that is the fact that entire neighborhoods are likely to sag. My wife and I went back to Aurora, Colorado a couple of years ago to see the place where she grew up, the house they were in, which was a middle-class neighborhood. It is no longer a middle-class neighborhood. It is somewhere down towards the very bottom of the class neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
The socioeconomic groups that lives there now are right around the bottom rung or near the bottom rung of socioeconomic groups. And when she was there, her father was a CPA and a professional, and it was an up-and-coming neighborhood. But you look at the little houses, the little frame houses on that street and the little brick houses on that street, and you say, wow, those are pretty cheap houses.
And how long ago were you there?
About 2 years ago,
okay.
3 years ago.
Because Denver is still in a real estate boom,
right.
And a lot of those old neighborhoods are being gentrified.
Well, this one didn't show any signs of gentrification. It was still sliding. It's in Aurora, which isn't in Denver proper, and I know that there are areas we could see the gentrification going on in town, Berry Creek and so on. Not Berry Creek, something Creek, but. The point is that this happens in every generation, that house, and the article was about places like the nearest place here that I can think of is Sun City. down in Georgetown. Of course, the article in the Wall Street Journal was about Sun City in Arizona and about concentrations in Florida. There's whole sections of housing in Florida that is very appropriate for older people. And the older people love it. And all their lawns are the same and all of their, and they have this wonderful lifestyle for older people. But they're already running into a problem. They're running short on older people to sell them to because the housing and the entire neighborhood is full of retired people. And for instance, Sun City has a ban on being below a certain age and living there. And eventually that is going to eventually that will turn around and bite them, and you will see Sun City turn into Sun Slum.
If they're not careful, it will. I mean, they are trying to keep it exclusive. And that's part of the attraction of a place like that, is they're trying to keep it exclusive. But this is the thing. If you look back to when this boom started, it's demographically. When were the births? So you look back at the baby boom generation. You look at that demographic.
You don't have to look back. You can just look over.
Or I can look over at you and the baby boom. But if we look at it demographically on a graph, you have this big hump of births. This is just large pile of births in the graph, which is kind of a messy sounding graph, if you ask me. But, you know, we look at these graphs all the time. There's a messy graph of a bunch of births that took place. And then you have this drop right after the boom. So the baby boom, everybody's back from the war. What do you do when you get back from the war? Well, you make babies. And so a lot of babies got made. Our population continued to net positive grow, even with that drop-off in baby births. But it took a while for it to kind of come back up to the same number of births. We're having more babies today, just as a side note, than we did at the boom of the baby boom. It's just less as a percentage of the population.
There's another factor here. When an entire neighborhood is built at the same time and aimed at a demographic group, like the one that's in the article in the Wall Street Journal, it was built in 1960. Those houses are 70 years old. And it's a simple fact.
Wait a minute. Where's your math coming from? You're 70. I know that you
60 years old.
There you go. All right.
Okay, they're 60 years old. But the point is that by the time they run into problem, they're going to be 70 years old. And a 70-year-old house is not, and the kitchens are different, and the bedrooms are different. Styles change over time. And when you have a concentration of houses in an area that are outmoded in their style and in their conveniences and in their ability to do whatever people want to do when they're younger.
It takes a great deal of reinvestment to get them up to normal standards.
They're really going to have to drop in value a long ways before people will be willing to come in as they are now in Austin, for example. They're buying houses from the 1940s in Austin now.
And fixing them up to today's standards.
And the point is because the houses got so cheap, there started this movement of buying those houses. In some cases, just taking a bulldozer and leveling and buying it for the lot. In other cases, adding on to the house and fixing it up and changing the kitchen and changing the bedrooms and changing the closets. And it's a very expensive process, but that's a natural factor. And and a lot of people, unfortunately, are thinking about, okay, when I'm 70 or 80 or whatever, I'll sell my house and it'll be worth a gazillion dollars or something. Well, if everybody else in your neighborhood has the same idea and they're all about the same age, this is what the article's about, then all of you are going to start trying to sell these old beat-up houses. They may not be beat-up to you, and it may be a wonderful house to you, but this old-style house at the same time, and at that point you will see the price of your neighborhood go down.
Right. And this is the point that I was coming with these demographics. That bulge, we're just beyond the peak of that bulge in the prime home buying years. So you're 70. We've talked about this a few times on the air. You're a baby boomer. You're kind of at the first few years of the baby boom generation. Are you planning on buying a new house that's bigger and better than your current house anytime soon?
That is a certainly negative, sir.
Okay, so this is anecdotal, but if you ask around to people in their 70s, are you planning on getting a bigger house than you have today? The vast majority of them, surprise, hold on for this, will say no. Okay, they're talking about downsizing. So that bulge means that we will be having, for the short term, at some point in the near future, expect those older houses to drop in value. They're the ones that haven't been dropping in value recently. They're bigger but older homes.
Yep.
And those values will drop. This is a normal cycle. Real estate in a portfolio needs to be balanced in a very different kind of way than just going out and getting a bunch of houses, which this would be interesting. Portfolio, most REITs and that sort of thing don't own large residential houses. Those are generally owned by the people that live there. REITs make their money either in commercial things, renting to businesses, hotels, that sort of thing, or on the very low end of the socioeconomic residential rental area. So the people that cannot afford their own homes, there's generally rent to be made there. And that's, people will, can talk about slumlords or they can talk about good landlords. There's the whole spectrum. And that's the thing, is that being aware that there's different parts of the real estate market, just like any other market, helps you prepare for downturns because they happen.
Things change, but things in process of changing just go through cycles and very much remain the same. I think that's the answer. Now, frankly, there's a couple of things that could really damage the price of houses. If we saw interest rates go up, if we see...
Well, a tornado, that damages the...
Not really.
You're talking macro.
Actually, after the tornado and you get to rebuild your house because you have insurance, the price of the house can go up.
Wait a minute. You have insurance that pays your mortgage. You don't have insurance that necessarily builds a new house. You got a new mortgage for that. So, especially if it doesn't completely destroy
it. I've got insurance that would replace
it.
The house.
So what you're saying is that a tornado damage does not affect the value of the house.
Not once it's repaired.
See, that's the thing.
No, but the point is...
We're talking more macro anyway.
The long scale reality is... that although houses can go up in value dramatically in a given location over a period of time, unless you happen to live in a rapidly expanding metropolitan area like Austin or San Francisco or someplace like that, it's cyclical. And they can go down as well as go up. And after a long period of time, it's hard to appreciate that. It's hard to understand. It's hard to remember it. But it's one of the things to bear in mind, and this article that the caller referred to is a very critical comment, very good comment. The fact is that you can go to neighborhoods that are 60, 70 years old and see that they have deteriorated dramatically from where they started 60 or 70 years ago. That happens to almost all neighborhoods eventually. You can go to New York City and see where... the wealthiest people in the world lived 100 years ago, and it is not exactly the most desirable neighborhood to live in today. Now, it's not to say that the prices have gone down, but once you factor in inflation, they haven't done that well. It's just something that never assume that just because something has been happening, it will continue to happen, particularly in this environment. Let's see.
I've got a thing here.
Okay.
In the same vein, even, U.S. pension buyout product sales were above $7.7 billion in the third quarter. That's from the Secure Retirement Institute, SRI.
Okay, to explain what that is.
What is a pension buyout? A pension buyout is either a company saying your pension is due, so I'm going to take my portion of the pension fund and buy an annuity for you, or you saying, individual investor saying, I don't want to manage my own money anymore, I'm going to buy an annuity to fund a pension for myself. It's the 19th straight quarter of growth in pension buyouts. This is, again, that baby boom bulge happening. Now, there's problems with that because anytime you have this much pension start, the demographics lift their head again. How long are these people going to live? Because the insurance companies that are issuing these products are basing their numbers on what they expect you to live based on a few years ago when the charts were done. And people's life expectancies, we've had some drops in the last couple of years in life expectancies, but the overall trend is upward. So if they make a bad bet on that pension, they could be left having to pay people when they don't have money to pay. So there are some demographic effects that we're seeing in the middle of this. And this is as important as the trade war is. As a percentage of our economy, it's pretty small. And that's something that people should know. I mean, it's making a lot of news right now, but in your car, on the highway, as you're driving, if you look around, it doesn't look any different than it did 3 years ago. There may be more trucks on the road, not less. So the trade war is having an effect on the growth, but the overall economy is so much bigger. If we have a peak at growth, in the fourth quarter of 1%.
Peak at growth? What's a peak at growth?
Kind of slow growth. Looking kind of weak. Right. Weak growth, of 1%, which is a little bit higher than a lot of economists are expecting for the fourth quarter. Of that growth, what percentage of that was from the trade war? The shrinkage of it? Well, maybe 20 basis points. And we may have, without the trade war expenses, now there's other factors and new investments not happening and so on that may be derived from the trade war. But the trade war itself, the expenses of the new imports, new exports, it's a very small portion of the economy. Underneath it, the big things that are going on are still going on. People are getting older, new babies are being born, unemployment, employment, all that stuff is based on how old you are, what your education level is, how productive you are in society, what's your work ethic. All that stuff is more demographic based. The trade war is making a lot of noise, but remember to keep an eye on the big things that are so common that nobody pay attention to them.
Let me give you an alternative definition of pension buyout. That is when you're retired from General Motors and General Motors says they'll pay you this many dollars for your pension.
Yeah.
And you gotta really understand what you're doing when you take that. Basically, the General Motors, like the vast majority of pensions in the United States, General Motors pension is underfunded. So they look at how much they're paying a retiree or a potential, when it comes time for you to retire and we'll give you a pension buyout. They look at that and say, if we give them this amount of money based on this, this formula, our pension fund will get healthier because it'll cost us less money to give them the money now than it will be to pay it out over their lifetime. So it's a complicated question. And there's a really good reason for all those pension buyouts, and that is that pensions are underfunded, and I want to get into that at some point.
And that's where I was going with the conversation.
Right.
You were very kind in the way you said it. I hadn't completed the definition. I got halfway into it and then said demographic stuff. You're absolutely right. The pension buyout is when all these annuities, all of these pensions, have issued the pension, which I already got to that part. They've issued the pension, and now they realize they don't have enough money to continue. They have enough money to buy out your portion of the annuity if you agree to it. You're going to be receiving X amount of money every month from them for the rest of your life according to their promise. And they say, well, we'll give you this lump sum instead. That's the pension buyout. And this, we've had 19 straight quarters of massive growth in pension buyouts. What that means is a lot of corporations are looking at their pensions and going, we can't afford to pay these.
And there's an ancillary to that that's very important. The corporation pension funds use the same formulas for building their pensions that annuity companies do.
In fact, a lot of the pensions that are run by the corporations are actually run by the insurance companies.
And there's a formula that's held up for years, a 60-40 portfolio or a 50-50 portfolio where a certain percentage is bonds and a certain percentage is stocks. And the problem with that assumptions, with all the assumptions that the pension funds and the annuities companies made over the years, was that they assume that they'll get a reasonable return out of their bonds. Well, right now, if you look at purchasing a new 10 or 20 year bond, it's investment grade, it is unlikely to fail, and you look at the return on it, you realize it's in the 1 to 2% range. And that is, maybe you, if you got 3%, you're doing exceptionally well, but you're taking some degree of risk. So when you take 40% of the portfolio and say, we'll get maybe 2.5% out of that portion of the portfolio, and the rest of the portfolio is got to make up the difference, but we can't be too aggressive because it's a pension fund. And then you look at the fact that people are living longer and longer and longer. Every time I do the calculations, I've looked at the numbers on several annuities that the advertisements come to me and they say, hey, why don't you sell this annuity to your clients? And I looked at the numbers, the payout on that annuity, and I just can't even, there's no way in the world as a person with a master's degree in this area that I can make the numbers in the bond and stock markets work to pay out as much money as that annuity is going to need to pay out if you live to a reasonable life expectancy. Now, why would annuity companies then do that?
Well, they expect that you're going to deplete the money over time.
Well, you're depleting the money.
Right.
But the point is that...
how do you make it last?
That it won't... there's no way that at that rate of distribution, that they're not going to go broke in 20 years. But the problem is the people who are running the company and the people who are selling it won't be in business to be getting in. And the statute of limitations and everything says there's nothing you can do about it 20 years from now when you go broke.
There are many, many companies that will rate pension plans. And the vast majority hold that one pension is the best one in the world. It's the Denmark pension. It's the government of Denmark's equivalent of Social Security, only you pay basically all the money that you're putting into your 401k, they put that into the pension instead. Well, they've recently made some statements that it's time for the European Union to change its pension rules because negative interest rates are really hard on pensions. They are saying, let me see here. The environment has become so punishing that it may be time for a change in European rules.
Right.
And that's a very understated. It's very much the way that the Danes speak. They don't ever come out and say, there's an emergency here. And pension people really don't say that. It's become so punishing that it is time for us to take a look at change in the rule system.
And the same thing is happening here, but we're not changing the rule system. When boards look at state boards of insurance, look at a annuity company and they say, how secure, how safe are they? They want to see a lot of bonds in the portfolio because they think bonds are safe. The problem is the low rate of return on those bonds puts them below inflation. So they have, in real terms, a negative return in many cases because they've got conservative bonds in the portfolio.
Right. Some of the earlier pensions were promising a payout of 4.5 or 5 or 6%. And when we're talking about Denmark, the highest that they were that were promised in that marketplace was a 4.5% payout. Well, that means with negative interest rates on bonds, they're going into the stock market to cover this. Anybody have any red flags that they would recommend waving at this point? Denmark has a red flag, so
it's a bad thing.
It's having, red with a white cross on it.
Right now, the yield on the S&P 500 stock index is equivalent to the yield on a intermediate term investment grade bond portfolio, which is unusual historically. So the bottom line to it is, if you're looking for income, which is what you buy bonds for, because in a rising interest rate environment, bonds will drop in value. The stock market could arguably be said for the long term, not for the short term, for the long term to be a more secure place than the bond market. That's not to say you shouldn't have bonds. Don't misunderstand me. But we're in a strange environment where the old rules of thumb that have been developed over the last 50 years simply don't work when you apply them to current interest rates. One of the big things that people overlook, and I mean, it's so built into our psyche today that people are even unaware that it's in there, is that bonds have been appreciating in value since about 1982 because interest rates have been dropping. Actually, 1980 is when they peaked. So 1980, so we're talking about 40 years now we've been in a bond bull market. But interest rates, the thing about a bond bull market, it's only a bull market as long as interest rates are dropping. And when they've gone to a negative position, unless they are caused to go more negative, or current interest rates in the United States drop to zero, which will be a devastating event, they eventually will rise again. And when they rise again, and I say when and if they rise again, it will devastate the bond market, and the organizations that are holding large quantities of bonds to support a retirement plan or an annuity are going to see some severe pain, and you're going to see a lot of them disappear. And we need to make some commercials appear.
Yes, we do. We must make commercials. They're not going to appear. They're going to go across the airwaves.
Yes.
We'll be back on the other side. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. It's 10:50 a.m. here on this Saturday, the 23rd of November. You know, I asked a couple of baby boomers the other day on Friday, what is special about today? And they drew a blank, which disappointed me horribly. Friday was a very special day, a day we swore we would never forget at the time. And we've forgotten it. It is a major event occurred, and at the time there was a universal outcry, and we said this is a day we will never forget, and now we've forgotten it.
What were we talking about?
November 22nd.
What? I can't remember the conversation. About remembering?
Yeah, all right, I got
remember.
You.
Remember. What we were talking about.
I just wonder if anybody knows what
November
Friday was the anniversary of that was a very significant event.
11/22.
Yes.
We have a caller on 773-1400.
Well, let's go to the caller.
Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
November 22nd is Kennedy assassination.
That's correct. November 22nd, 1963. But it's amazing the number of people who don't remember that, who were alive at the time. Anyway, go ahead.
Hey, I have a question, and don't want to interrupt your thoughts, but would you comment sometime during the show on the international division of Walmart opening 500 new stores in China?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All right.
Walmart China, yes.
The Walmart China deal.
Well, you've got the biggest consumer market in the world and you're a consumer store,
it kind of makes sense.
Staying out of it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah. You have to remember this is important, especially right now. Corporations have an obligation to their shareholders to follow the law, but also to do what they claim they want to do. So if they say they want to do something, they kind of have an obligation to go down that path. Walmart, when it was a growth company, do you guys remember that? Do you remember when Walmart was a growth company?
Yes.
Wasn't that long ago. Growth companies are exploring new territory and opening up new marketplaces. They're going to places that they've never been before, and they've got new buyers, people that want to come and buy from them. So it was a big deal in my childhood when a Walmart came to a local town, a local city. It was a big deal because Walmart had all kinds of things that you couldn't get without going to 20 stores. And it may be a significant factor in malls going downhill. We put a lot of blame on online retail sales, but the reality is that Walmart sucked up a lot of that market from the malls. But now there's Walmarts everywhere. It's kind of like the Starbucks thing. People make jokes about Starbucks in the big cities because you can step out of a Starbucks and cross the street and go into another Starbucks. Starbucks has begun in the last 5 years to close down some of those because they realize that by opening more stores, that doesn't automatically mean more profit. You're taking some of that profit away from the store across the street. So you've just spent more money to get the same business. Walmart's there already. So where do they go if they want to expand the marketplace?
Walmart has made its money by going into places where there's a lot of little stores and opening up a big box store.
And we just described China.
And China is a place where there's a lot of little stores, and the concept of the big box store really hasn't caught on yet. And the I would imagine the Chinese, the first time they go into a Walmart, are just as mind-boggled as I was the first time I went into a Walmart. China is not... Well, let me say this a little awkwardly, a little strange.
Say it as awkwardly as possible. That's what we do.
China is not our enemy. Why do I say that? Japan, during World War II, for example, wanted to take over most of Asia and the Pacific, including the islands in the middle of the Pacific that were property of the United States.
Right.
Germany wanted to take over
Europe. And to some extent, Asia.
And the world as needed. Those are enemies. China, yes, wants to expand its boundaries out into the ocean somewhat.
They're a competitor.
But they're not, they don't have as a primary goal to conquer the United States or to conquer anybody around them specifically.
Well, I mean, the South China Sea, the Seven Dash Line.
Yeah, but that's not a nation.
They're making new land. They're not really taking it from some, well, they're taking the water, but.
China, yes, plays by a different, by far, well, not different, a more primitive set of rules. They want to play by the rules that we played by in the early 20th and late 19th century, the robber baron rules.
Right.
They want to play by the same rules that we thought were normal 100 years ago.
They were kind of normal 100 years ago. We were just the best at them at the time.
And before that, the Europeans thought were normal, and that goes right down to pollution and everything else. And China is out there. They definitely were trying to take mercantile advantage of their what they consider their competitors, which companies do, and China Incorporated has done and is doing. But
then let's be relatively fair here. We have taken advantage of them as well.
Sure,
and that's what happens in business is that sometimes people get taken advantage of.
And there was a time that the Chinese
they've done it a lot more than we have.
There's a time that the Chinese remember very, very well in their history lessons and in their culture. When China was divided up into sections that were the exclusive right territories of various empires, including the United States, we had a chunk of China that the Europeans would stay out of, and we would do exclusive business there, and we basically
using pretty much monopoly type rules of not allowing any Chinese businesses to compete.
That, and we as well as the Europeans. We're importing drugs from Southeast Asia and selling them in China, opium, which is to calm the, I mean, we're doing things that would be totally forbidden to do in the United States. Now, that's not to say,
and they'd be forbidden to do today outside the United States, but at the time it was a normal practice.
That's not to say the Chinese are obeying our rules or obeying the rules of the International Trade Association or anything else. I'm simply saying, or the World Trade Organization. I'm simply saying that China is not the kind of enemy that, for instance, Russia was during the Cold War. Russia wanted to conquer Europe and the United States.
Yeah.
The Soviets had this dream of world domination, and that included the United States as their principal enemy. The Chinese are devoting some money to their armed forces, but if you look at the percentage of their GDP they're devoting to their armed forces and the percentage we devote to our armed forces, there's just no comparison.
So what this is a popularity thing. Walmart is kind of the essence of an American company. It's about how do we get low prices to people and make a profit doing it. You could look at how Sears started, what Amazon's doing. It's a model that has gone back since there have been businesses, but that the Americans have really been pushing. And it works. The model that the Chinese are pushing is kind of a predatory model. Walmart's, you know, there are people that you can talk to on the left end of the political spectrum that will say that Walmart is a horrible place because it put all the mom and pop businesses out. if it wasn't Walmart, it would have been someone else, because we demand as a people lower prices and better selection. If there's a demand in the market, somebody's going to give to that demand. In China, there's a demand. I see Walmart going in there as it's a risky move in this political environment, because they might get boycotted. They might have some kind of extra level of tariffs come in as a direct target to a governmental action back or forth. But the long term is, this is the kind of marketplace that Sam Walton built them to fill. It's just in a different language. So it's a risky move.
Let me put something in perspective here about China that we easily could overlook. China has about 280 nuclear weapons, and France has 300. United Kingdom, Pakistan has half the number of nuclear weapons, and we got a break.
We are out of time. If you want to call us off the air, it's 254-947-1111. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and we'll be back next hour with more of The Personal Wealth Coach.